I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root Artist feature. I have the pleasure today of speaking with Emmy-nominated spoken word artist John Good. John, how are you?
I'm well. Yourself, sir?
Doing very well. Happy to have you in today. Let's start at the beginning.
So
Richmond, Virginia.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I thought you meant in the, you know, there was darkness and then light. All right, Richmond, Virginia. Yes.
Well, your beginning.
Yes. Okay.
Let's start with your beginning first. So talk about growing up in Richmond.
I grew up on the south side of Richmond, Virginia. Richmond, Virginia is a town that is built on tobacco. So I grew up in a neighborhood called Oak Grove, Bellmead, Blackwell. And every few days, the entire neighborhood smelled like cigarettes because Philip Morris, like, runs Richmond. So we grew up with this wonderful backdrop of every morning waking up to smelling tobacco and or cigarettes. And then from there, the cigarettes that infested the neighborhood, then came the drugs, which made it a serious place to grow up in. But I had these wonderful parents that would not let me stray too far from the path. They kept me on a very straight and narrow path. And they made sure I went to college and got my stuff together. And that was Richmond. God bless it.
How often do you get back home?
Not very often at all. And every time I go back, I remember why I left.
Okay. And when you think about your childhood and how you have grown and traveled since then, what, outside of those early memories about tobacco, what stays with you?
The thing about my early childhood that stays with me the most is I think of, like, Robert Frost when he speaks about taking the road less traveled, and how me and several of my friends, we all start off in the same place, and we all, through, you know, nature or nurture, however you look at it, chose different paths to take, and how easily any of us could have gone down, you know, the other path. So I have one good friend that just got out of prison he was in prison for 22 years. He just got out 2 or 3 years ago. Another good friend is homeless. Another good friend that still sells the same 20 sack of weed he's been selling for the last 30 years on the same corner. And his claim to fame is he's never left the south side of Richmond. That's his claim to fame. He calls himself Southside Rod. I've never even went to the north side of Richmond. And I was like, how crazy is this? You could cross a bridge and double your world. Like, this is not something to be proud of. So I think about that. I think about how easily I could have been Rod or Greg or Vincent or any of these cats. And that stays with me, you know, like, it stays with me in so much as I don't take my life or my choices for granted.
So when it comes to your art, and before HBO and Deaf Poetry Jam and before CNN and before TV One, excuse me, before the public recognized your work, when did you recognize that you had something?
That's so interesting, because sometimes I'm still trying to recognize it. Like, sometimes I hear amazing things, like things that make you just want to throw your pen away. And you're like, what am I doing? This guy's so good. Or this woman just said something so amazing. Like, you know, where am I going with this? So I'm always still trying to, I don't know, improve and become a better me and I don't know, find the most authentic version of my voice that I can find. But back in 97, 98, I went to the Yin Yang Cafe, and I heard a group of amazing poets that night, like some of the best poets I've ever heard to this day. And that's when I said to myself, I think there's a possibility that I might be able to do this. So I went home and wrote my first poem for the stage, and I've never gotten off the stage since.
And when it comes to spoken word, this oral tradition that has been around for thousands of years.
Yes.
When do you sense that innovation has happened, or when a corner has been turned, because it has been around for so long?
Yeah, I mean, spoken word is, it's so interesting because it ebbs and flows. You know, like, you have these moments when everyone loves it, and then you have these moments when nobody's checking for it. You know, so Love Jones comes out and everybody's at the spots doing really bad poetry. And then Love Jones dies down and no one's checking for it. And then Deaf Poetry comes, and then everyone didn't miss the rap train and the R&B train jumps on the poetry train because clearly this gets you on TV. And then deaf poetry stops and then all those people go away. So it grows and shrinks. It ebbs and flows. And you'll look up and you'll see that some people stay with it. Like this is truly their passion, the thing they're dedicated to. And you see that some people just come and go because they never had their heart in it. So, I mean, it changes. It has innovation to it. I think, you know, with language, you know, as the lexicon grows, the art form grows, you find different ways to say things. I mean, poetry is informed by everything, by, you know, hip hop, R&B, books. Everything ends up showing up in those poems. So I think as, you know, art in itself grows, poetry seems to grow and change and move with it.
Well, when you contextualize spoken word with poetry.
Yes.
Not in terms of a weight, but when you're approaching your work, mm-hmm. how much attention or what different types of attention, I would say, do you give to the words that are written mm-hmm. and your performance of those words?
Some poems that I write are strictly for the page. Even in the way they're written, there's certain things that I do visually with the words and structure that you can only see it on a page. You know, I couldn't make it appear in front of you and do what it's doing there. Some stuff is written expressly for the stage. I write it with an audience in mind. I don't write for an audience, but I write with the knowledge that I'm going to put this in front of people. So I need to write it in a way that people can digest, understand, in some way be entertained, whether that entertainment be they laugh or they cry or they sit and think. It has to move them in some way. When people say, I don't care about the audience, when people say this, I always think with them, why would you do it? Why would you walk in front of a group of people if you don't care about the audience? You can stay in your room, recite it to yourself in the mirror if you do not care about the audience. Do not, you know, encumber the audience with this awful work if you don't care.
The words that you write for an audience, you obviously have an outlet for those.
Yes.
What about the words that you write that are for the page? Where do you find an outlet for those thoughts?
I mean, they end up, I'm about to publish a book, another book. They end up in, you know, books and blogs. It's interesting when you go to publishers' websites, a lot of them have written very big letters. We want no poetry submissions. They tell you in very clear language, we do not want to hear nor read your poems. So
why is that, by the way?
I think the poetry books don't sell. It's a business at the end of the day for them. And I think for them, they don't think poetry books sell very well. I think the last few I read, Saul Williams had some poetry books. But, you know, Saul is a guy that has kind of transcended a bit. Like, you know, he's kind of bigger than spoken word, bigger than poetry itself. He's like another thing. So MTV was publishing books for him for a while. But the average poet ends up on either publishing, self-publishing, or they end up on like very small, you know, presses like what is it, brick store press, I think it's called, something like this that Iodelli is on. They end up on presses like that, or they just, you know, publish it themselves.
So when it comes to the actual performance of your work,
yes.
Take me through the iterative process of maybe how you get to a point where you know this work is ready for presentation.
Yeah, I write, when I'm writing a poem, whatever reaction I want from the audience, I first have that reaction within myself. So when I'm writing a poem that I think is funny, I laugh at the poem as I'm writing it. If I don't laugh, then it's just not funny. If I'm writing a poem that I want to move the audience in some way, it has to move me in that way. If it's going to make the audience cry, it has to damn near make me cry. Like, you know, this is how I write poems. And then after I feel like I've tweaked it and I've, you know, put it down here on the anvil and I've hammered it, then comes, you know, the stage where you memorize and put it in front of an audience. And once you put it in front of an audience, you see, you know, how it moves that audience. And sometimes it goes well and sometimes it doesn't. And when it doesn't go well, you have to ask yourself, did I not write it right? Did I write it right and I didn't deliver it correctly? Or is this poem just not ready? And you have to be very, very honest with yourself about these things. Some poems I've had to look at and say, this just isn't going to work for an audience. I'm going to have to totally scrap this and come back. And sometimes I say, I'm just not saying it right. If I say it different, it's gonna work. I just have to figure out, you know, within myself, what's going to make this resonate with that room full of people.
Now, do you have other peers who give you feedback? Because as I'm listening to you talk, I think about comedians.
Yeah.
And I was listening to, maybe it was Kevin Hart, and he was talking about him and Chris Tucker, him and Chris Rock.
Mm-hmm.
They were working out, as they call it. And then they went to go to this place, and then Dave Chappelle appears on stage because he was doing the same thing. And both of them are at the back of the crowd like, yeah, we're not ready yet.
Right, right.
These jokes that we had aren't quite ready yet. And they have this inner circle of pure respect where they can give feedback in that kind of way. Do you have that same type of inner circle?
I do. I have that. And I feel so fortunate to have come out of this yin yang room where it was a group of amazingly honest, like, artists, and they weren't super sensitive. Today, a lot of people are so amazingly sensitive that they cannot take criticism in any kind of way. But the group of people that I came out of this room with, Fahamu Peku, Cola Rum, Kimbo, Tom, these people, you would do a poem and they would look at you and say, that's not ready. That needs some work. And you might feel some kind of way for, you know, 5 good minutes. You like, you know, But then, you know, you like, yeah, okay, they right. And you go home and you work on it, and then you bring it back, and it is better. And they'll say, oh, okay, yeah, no, you murdered it. You did that. And I feel like you need that kind of honest dialogue, and you need to be able to see that within yourself. So in the example you gave, when they hear Chappelle, they say to themselves, this is not ready. And some people just can't seem to do that. They can't seem to look at their own work and say, although I have birthed this thing, this child, this child is not ready to go to school. This child needs to stay home and suckle from the teat a bit more before I send it off to class. So that's important. I think it's an important thing for an artist to be able to do for themselves. So at the yin yang was not a competition. It was just an open mic, but we treated it like a competition every week. So at the end of the night, people would say to you, like, you won. You had the best poem of the night. Even though it's not a competition, they would just all acknowledge, like, you killed it. It was your night. And some nights, somebody would be so hot what they were doing. Other people would scratch their names off the list, like, what I was about to do is not ready. Or they would scratch their name off the list and say, what you're doing is so good, I'd like to hear you do another poem. I'm going to give you my slot. And that never happens today. Like, that never happens. It doesn't matter how God awful this poem is, they're going to say it, and they're going to say it everywhere all the time. And there's nothing you can say it, you can say to them that needs some work, or that's just not, I don't know if that's ever going to be ready. But I don't know, it's a different ethos running in the world today. It's just different.
Well, switching gears.
Okay.
In terms of a different ethos, I think that a lot of people can see some of the parallels between spoken word and hip hop in terms of language use and presenting words to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a difference, obviously, but I would love to get your perspective on your process as you would know it to be different than rappers who are engaging in their process. So talk about the process that you have, the intent, and how you approach your craft that may be either similar or different than what people would assume when they look at a lot of hip hop artists out there.
Well, and I think it depends on, you know, of course, which hip hop artist you're talking about. You know,
fair enough, right?
Like a Talib Kweli is not going to take the same approach, you know, as a Gucci Mane. You know, they have different objectives with where they're going with the work. But I think for a lot of hip-hop artists, what they're trying to create is so musically driven. It's so driven by a beat. So they are confined within the bars of this beat, which is sad. You hate to think of black men stuck behind bars. But they're confined within the bars of this beat, and that's where they're at. As a spoken word artist, anything I want to do, I can do. Like, it feels more like an organic jazz thing. If I want to rhyme, I can. If I don't want to rhyme, I can end a rhyme scheme. It can be, you know, within a syncopation, off of a syncopation. I could take a long pause. I could say a word and just let it hang out there for a moment and come back in. Like, there are no limits There's nothing confining me to what I can do on that stage other than the limitations of my mind itself. So I'm not chained to the structure of, you know, like when I talk to hip hop artists, they always like, you know, yo, John, I want you to jump on this album. You give me 16 bars. And I'm like, okay, I'll see if I can make it fit. I'm just going to say what I got to say, and let's hope it falls within those 16 bars. It doesn't exactly work this way, you know, for me. But I think that as far as message goes, it just depends on the artist. You know, I mean, you pick up a guy, you know, Homeboy Sandman. You pick up a, you know, a Talib Kweli. You know, it's amazing artists out there that they have things to say. Now, whether the radio is going to let them say it on their airwaves is a different thing. But there are definitely artists out there crafting a lot of just, you know, really, really heartfelt, wonderful work. And then, of course, there are artists that are not. And their thing is they just want to, you know, they just, you know, they're so fancy. Everybody knows, you know, they're in the fast lane from L.A. to Tokyo. They're doing that thing, you know, it's just for airwaves and for play. They don't care what it does to the child, to the mind of your child, to their morals. They don't care about anything. All they want to know is how many zeros are going to be in this check. That's like the end all be all of where they're going. So, you know, I just looked at Nicki Minaj's single, her album cover. Have you seen this?
I've not seen it. No,
it's I'm like, it's amazing with it. It's amazing where that art form goes. Like it's such.
I think I have seen it now that you mention it.
It's just her. It's her butt. Basically.
I have seen. Okay. So that is the
Anaconda's cover for this single.
I did not know that that's what it was for.
Yes, it's for her single. This song called Anaconda. That's the cover for the single. It's like her bare ass. And I'm like, it amazes me. It just turns into it's a clear, you know, you're clearly just pandering to this audience to try to keep yourself relevant. You're somehow threatened by this new artist out, so you got to show I have a bigger ass than that artist has. You know, instead of, I guess, picking up a microphone and saying I am actually more talented than you, you will say I can take off far more clothes than you can, and I can look better doing it, and that's going to sell my record.
Well, let me ask you this. For those hip-hop artists that can take the what for some people is a confining situation of the bars and the beat, mm-hmm. and manipulate that and use that to create a moment where yes. their words and that music becomes greater than the sum of those things.
Yes.
As a spoken word artist, how do you embrace or, I guess, receive their art?
Oh, I love it, man. It's cast. I was just speaking with Adam Bean of the Remnant last night. We were talking about these moments, you know, in recent hip hop and, you know, in hip hop of the not so, you know, not so long ago. Fonte, he's so good at it. He has a song about relationships where he's talking about, you know, his wife and her leaving and how he looks in the rearview mirror and, you know, sees this empty baby seat. Like, the way he paints it is so beautiful. Like, it'll make you pause. You'll pause the recording, and you just sit there like, my goodness, my God. And you get chills just listening to that type of stuff. Fonte will do it. Of course, Mos Def has done it several times. Homeboy Sandman does it for me a lot these days. Like, just writes this really, really beautiful stuff. There's this guy, Chance the Rapper, has moments, these, like, beautiful moments. Early on, not today, not so much today, but early on, Jay-Z used to do it. Jay-Z has this song called You Must Love Me that has like this verse in there where he's talking about getting into it with his brother. Do you know this song?
I do.
Where he gets into it with his brother, and out of like jealousy and anger, he ends up shooting his brother. And he does that, you know, that line where he's, running in the circle thinking I'm assed out, hot pistol in my waist, ran straight to Jazz House. Like, damn, I just shot my nigga. And ran off in the night like it was not my nigga. Like that thing right there, like it'll give you chills listening to that song. Jay-Z doesn't do that anymore. But there's these moments where these artists, especially before it turns into like a real, real money thing, they give you these wonderful slices of life.
So what's next for you from this perspective? Let's say this is where you are right now, given your current career state. Where do you want to go?
At the end of the day, I see myself writing for like film and television, which I'm moving in that direction anyway. And, you know, God willing, it'll pick up some momentum and keep moving in that direction. So I think of myself as a writer of all things, you know, whether it be a poem, a novel, a play, a ransom note, whatever it is, I'm going to write it beautifully. If I write your ransom note, they will give you the money. They will give you the money.
Well, John, let all of our listeners know how they can learn more about you and get in contact with you.
I have a website. It's www.johngood.webs.com. And that's JONGOODE.WEBS.com. I'm on Facebook. It's John Good and John Good Poet. I'm on Twitter. It's John Good. I'm on Instagram. It's John Good. I'm around. I'm easy to find. And I'm going to be on next.
Well, John Good, writer of all things.
Yes.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.